Calling Bednar v. Bednar, A24-0080. We're ready for argument, beginning with appellant's counsel. Be sure to state your name for each leg of your argument so we have you identified on our oral recording of the arguments this morning. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Matthew Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T, representing the appellant, Craig Bednar. This matter should be pretty simple, but on January 20th of 2021, Mr. Bednar filed a motion to compel arbitration. As a part of that motion, there was no objection to it. There was no summary judgment motion filed regarding the validity of a prenuptial agreement that the parties had both signed.
Is it that you think should have gone to arbitration? Which issues?
The issues over the division of property division.
All property division?
All property division. Well,
what does the arbitration clause in the anti-nuptial provision, relevant provision, say about requiring arbitration?
If there's any dispute regarding the division of separate property, then that dispute needs to go to binding arbitration.
And by separate property, do we mean marital property?
Really non-marital property?
Non-marital. You're
right.
Absolutely right. I'm sorry. But doesn't the provision say if there's any dispute regarding the value of separate property, that goes to arbitration?
It does, but in order to determine the value of the non-marital property, that's really kind of the division of that property, if that makes sense, Your Honor.
Well, why doesn't the value of the property simply mean what is this non-marital property worth at this time?
And it's really identifying the value and what is separate property and what's not. And in order to do that, in order to ascertain a value to separate property or non-marital property, the arbiter would have to decide what is separate property and what is not separate property.
Right.
And with that, the arbiter would necessarily have to make a determination regarding the validity of the prenuptial agreement. With that, the prenup...
Why couldn't it work this way? The antinuptial identifies what is separate property for each party. If there is a dispute over the value of any of the property listed in the antinuptial, that dispute goes to arbitration to set a value, and then the district court sorts out everything else, including whether or not the separate property, as valued by an arbitrator, maintained its separate property status, or was there commingling, those sorts of things.
Your Honor, I think...
Why wouldn't we just use the arbitrator for that baseline determination? What are these things listed in the antinuptial worth at this point in time?
Your Honor, it should have been used in that capacity, but again, just the way it's worded, it would have required the arbitrator to determine what is non-marital property that should be valued and what is the value of that property. And with that, the arbiter would ultimately have to determine whether the antinuptial agreement's valid.
That seems intellectually dishonest to me. You're here arguing, I assume, that the antinuptial was valid. And if the antinuptial specifically identifies what is the separate property of each party, why doesn't that determination start the analysis? And then the next step is, what is it worth? And then if there are other related arguments having to do with commingling assets, such things, those would go to the district court. It seems that you're trying to turn the arbitration clause into something that would resolve all the issues in a dissolution case relating to property.
And Your Honor, the arbitration clause, in my opinion, it's pretty clear that this is the forum that the parties had agreed upon to divide their property. And again, and as a part of doing that, the arbiter would have to make that determination regarding the validity of the prenuptial agreement.
But the exact language says, any controversy solely arising out of the valuation of their net separate property. And there's a lot more in dispute here, and so it's not solely arising out of the valuation of their net separate property. And so, it could be that the non-marital goes to arbitration, but everything else needs to be in front of a district court.
And acknowledge it could be interpreted that way, but again, in order for an arbiter to determine the value, they have to determine what is non-marital and what is marital.
But why, if the antenuptial is valid, why does the arbitrator have to do that? You've got a document that tells you what's marital and what's non-marital.
Well, I think there was a dispute at that point, and that's why issue was...
Why does that dispute go to the arbitrator and not to the district court when it's the language says solely relating to the value of non-marital assets, and the non-marital assets are identified in the antenuptial? Wouldn't we just look to the antenuptial and say, okay, for the purposes of arbitration, if we're concerned about the value of any non-marital property listed in this agreement, the valuation goes to arbitration?
That's the exact determination the arbiter should have made. What's non-marital? What's the value? And even if the court found that even if the court doesn't apply the arbitration clause, the prenuptial agreement is still valid.
Okay. Do you believe the district court erred in determining that the antenuptial agreement was invalid?
Your Honor, there's four Kinney factors that the court was required to consider. The court only analyzed one Kinney factor. They're balancing factors, so the court needs to analyze all four. The court can't just rely upon one. The fatal factor found by the district court was that there was a claim of duress that was made. Both parties were represented by, frankly, large law firms. They spent a lot of money and a lot of time negotiating this prenuptial agreement. It's much different than the Kramer case, where a prenuptial agreement was presented 3 days before a wedding date. Here, this was negotiated, I believe, over a six-month time period.
And the wedding was actually continued once because they couldn't reach agreement regarding the terms, correct?
I don't know about that fact, but I don't doubt that fact. And again, if it can be continued, it can be continued at any time. So if it's hard to claim there's duress, if that's always an option, just to continue the wedding date. The prenuptial agreement was signed 2 days before the wedding by the parties' respective attorneys, and then the day before the wedding by the parties itself. We've cited a case basically saying a prenuptial agreement signed 2 days before a wedding is not duress in itself. And there's got to be some very compelling circumstances to meet that high standard of duress. With that, the court analyzed the enforcement of the agreement and found that while it was fair and equitable, at the time it was signed, at the time of enforcement, it was the trial court found that it was not fair. It was unconscionable at that time. And we've cited various cases where circumstances changed drastically, including a party having a 300-fold increase in their circumstances.
Did the district court correctly apply the relevant term of the antenuptial agreement when doing the comparative analysis of the outcome in terms of what wife would get?
So the court analyzed the enforcement as of 2023.
Okay.
When in Hennepin County, the presumed valuation date is 2019, when the ICMC date had occurred. And I think they have a true analysis, it should have been as of that 2019 date.
What does the antenuptial agreement say in terms of what's the valuation date?
Your Honor, the antenuptial agreement is very detailed. I believe it's about 20 pages. I don't know if there's a specified valuation.
I think what
date.
It says is that with regard to the percentage allocation of marital property, is it marital or non-marital, in the chart on page 12, that the way to do the calculation is that wife gets, based on the number of years married, a percentage of the difference between the value of husband's non-marital property and wife's non-marital property as valued at the time of service of the dissolution petition.
And that sounds correct, Your Honor.
And that would have been 2019?
That's correct.
Okay. And what does the record tell us, or the district court's findings tell us, about husband's the value of husband's non-marital property in 2019 as opposed to 2023?
Your Honor, this case is frankly very sad. My client, as you can see in the prenuptial agreement, had
I'm just looking
tens
for numbers.
Of millions of dollars.
Just looking for
at
numbers.
At the time, yeah. He had considerably less than what he brought into the marriage, and frankly, now he's basically got nothing.
What did the district court say he had in 2019?
I don't know offhand what the district court found, but again, the analysis should have been back to 2019 and consistent with other case law. A change, which happens all the time in party circumstances, doesn't necessarily mean it's substantively unconscionable. With that, the court can review non-marital claims de novo. And we ask the court to do that here, especially as it relates to the marital homestead. In the prenuptial agreement, even if it wasn't invalid or wasn't valid, the prenuptial agreement provides that Mr. Bednar has a homestead. He owns the homestead.
Let me ask you this. If this court were to determine that the antinuptial agreement was valid and the district court erred in concluding otherwise, what happens next? Or what would you like to see happen next?
If the court were to determine it was invalid?
It was valid.
Well, it was valid. Then the terms of the agreement should be put in place. And it's clear what those are.
So we would remand for the district court to reconsider its decisions in light of the provisions in the antinuptial agreement.
Correct. And arbitration should be triggered regarding the value and separation of the non-marital assets.
The district court's order contains, you know, several other provisions having to do with spousal maintenance and child support. Are they impacted by a determination that the antinuptial agreement is valid?
They are, and that's
also
set forth in the prenuptial agreement. There's a provision, well, regarding spousal maintenance, but as the court is aware, spousal maintenance is a factor related to child support. So they would both be impacted by...
Okay, so the antinuptial addresses spousal maintenance.
It does, Your Honor.
How about attorney's fees?
It does. It would resolve... And again, the reason for these contracts is it helps resolve a lot of issues.
Does it address the child custody issue?
It does not. And
right. Could you explain why you feel the district court erred in its custody determination? Let's just say, for the sake of argument, the district court erred in finding domestic abuse. Does that change the outcome of this case? Specifically, there is a presumption in favor of joint custody. Can that presumption be rebutted? And if so, was it rebutted based solely on the evidence and findings regarding your client's significant health issues?
Your Honor, there is a presumption in favor of joint legal custody that can be rebutted if there is domestic abuse.
Okay. Are you saying that the presumption it can be rebutted in no other way other than domestic abuse?
That's what's contemplated by statute, but it can be rebutted in other ways if there's findings.
So what I'm asking you is, why did the district court, would it be harmless error, the domestic abuse finding, if in fact the medical records testimony and findings rebutted that presumption? In other words, a district court would look at this and say, given his health concerns, he can't be entrusted with, you know, the full-time care and custody of the child or part-time care and custody of the child.
And Your Honor, under statute, the court is required to make detailed findings if there is a finding of domestic abuse, and that's one of the bases for why legal custody would, the presumption would not apply. Including kind of the incidences of domestic abuse and whether they're capable of repetition. There's no analysis of that statutory factor, and we believe that should have been made. And really, I mean, this case is a paradox.
Analysis of which statutory factor?
Sure. Give me a second here. It's 518.17, subdivision 1B9.
And what does that say?
And it essentially says that... and I don't have the statute in front of me, but it essentially provides that there has to be further analysis if there's domestic abuse and if that domestic abuse is the basis for overcoming the
statutory presumption. But my question is, what if we were to agree with you and say the record doesn't support a finding of domestic abuse? Would that matter if The record otherwise supports a finding that the presumption favoring joint custody has been rebutted, specifically the record regarding father's medical conditions and the impact it has had on his younger son, as described in the record and as found by the district court.
Your Honor, legal custody refers to who makes the major education, religion, healthcare decisions on behalf of the child. If my client, he does have very serious health issues.
But wasn't he requesting joint physical and legal?
He was, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, what about the physical component?
So the presumption applies to the legal custody. There's no presumption with regard to physical custody. His health is a factor, a statutory factor, regarding his ability to care for the child. But it's really a paradox here, saying that his health is so hampered that he's endangers his children and his parenting time should be supervised, while at the same time finding he's capable of working and earning $30,000 per month. With that, there's no factual finding supporting that $30,000 per month figure. And that was roughly based off of a business that has been insolvent and has been subject to a receivership and a bankruptcy. And I see I'm out of time here. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. We'll talk again. All right. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure, I didn't mean to rush you. Take your time.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Linda DeBeer, and I represent the respondent, Stacy Bednar. As I was preparing for oral argument today, I realized that really this case is about the factual findings and the standards of review. Both appellant and respondent have provided this court a lot of different cases and legal analysis, but the reality is the answers are all within the decree. This is a very detailed, well-drafted decree. The body of it is 65 pages. There are almost 200 findings. I think it's like 193 or something.
But if the district court erred in its analysis, we've got to deal with that.
So that's true.
Let me ask you this. Yes. Let's get right to it.
Yeah.
It appears to me that the majority of the district court's decisions in this case rise and fall on the district court's determination that the antinuptial was invalid because it was the result of coercion and because it was unconscionable when compared to time of initiation and the time of trial.
Yes.
First question I have is about the coercion. The district court, you know, basically said, you know, in Kremer, someone was asked to sign a prenuptial 3 days before a destination wedding. That was coercion. But in that case, according to the facts stated in the opinion, husband and had broached the subject of the need for a prenup with his fiance, and she indicated, I would not be open to that. Husband nonetheless took her tax records to an attorney over the period of a month and formulated a prenuptial agreement, which husband presented to her 3 days before a destination wedding and said, if you don't sign this, the wedding's off. Here, we have an affidavit from your client indicating that husband told her up front, I won't get married without an antinuptial agreement. They both got attorneys who zealously represented them, as indicated in your client's affidavit. Her attorneys were constantly telling her, he won't budge on things. We're trying to get provisions that provide better for you, but he won't budge. This went on for 6 months or thereabouts. At some point, the wedding was set for April. Wife said, we continued the wedding because we had yet to come to agreement regarding the prenuptial. But we continued to negotiate. We continued to plan. Even though she knew he wasn't getting married without the antinuptial, even though she knew her lawyers were not obtaining the terms she wanted, she went ahead and planned the wedding, paid for everything, they're still negotiating, and then the day before the wedding, she decides to sign, saying, well, we couldn't call the wedding off at that point. To me, that seems like two very different sets of circumstances. In one, there was a surprise, got you, sign this or we're not getting married, when wife had told husband, I'm not willing, I'm not comfortable. In this case, we've got husband telling wife from day one, I'm not getting married without a prenup, and they're negotiating for 6 months with lawyers, so much so that the first wedding date gets continued, and then wife goes forward with the second date. I'm not seeing wife in this case as being in the same sort of situation as Kremer, where someone was literally surprised 3 days before the wedding with a prenup. Could you address those differences?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that it comes down to, again, the standard of review and deference to the trial court. And the factual findings of duress are just that. It's a factual finding. The antenuptial...
But what, I mean, the factual finding has to be supported by the record. And you're saying it's duress. Well, the district court specifically said it's duress just like Kremer.
Yes.
What if it's not just like Kremer? The facts are not similar. Is that not error?
But it's a factual finding. Because this trial court may have a view different from Your Honor or different from other trial courts. But the reality is the view of that being duressed is a factual finding.
But and the district court specifically tells us it's duress because this is just like Kremer. And it's not just like Kremer.
And no
case. So doesn't that indicate, I mean, a factual finding is an error if we're left with a definite and firm conviction that it's incorrect. And if we're looking at the district court's reasoning in saying this is duress, and we say, yeah, definite and firm conviction, that reasoning was incorrect, doesn't that impact the factual finding?
It does, but it's also why we have the deference to the trial court, Your Honor, because we could ask 10 different trial courts for their opinion on what they believe is duress, and they'll have different opinions on it. What we have here, though, is a finding that is supported by the record, even if we might disagree with it.
Understood. Let's move on to the next part of the analysis of the antinuptial agreement. And that is the district court's determination that the agreement was unconscionable at the time of enforcement. And just because time's limited, I'm not going to play games. I'll just get right to it.
Yeah.
I've read the antinuptial several times.
28 pages, yes.
As I understand it, according to its pretty clear terms, if there's a divorce, well, here's what the district court did. The district court said, here's a chart that says what percentage of the non-marital property mother gets upon dissolution, and it's based on how many years they've been married.
Yes.
The district court said, well, at the time this was executed, his finances were way up here. At the time, and I think they were about $7 million, at the time of trial, he's down to $1.5 million. Take 14 or 12% of that. She's only ended up with $900,000. That's unconscionable. My concern is, and one thing that has been pointed out in appellant's brief, is that the antinuptial says that when you're applying the provision, which the district court applied to reach its determination that the antinuptial was unconscionable, you're supposed to apply that provision to the non-marital assets in existence when the dissolution is initiated, which would have been 2019. And the district court's own findings say in 2019, when the dissolution began, his financial circumstances were much better. He had $2 million in this, $1.5 million in this, the undetermined value of the other business. So it seems to me those are the marital assets to which the district court should have applied the percentage and based on which the district court should have done its comparison. Because if you're taking 12% of $1.5 million, that's very different than 12% of maybe $5 million, it looks like. So I see that as an error, and I see it as an error that impacted the judge's finding, if you will, that it was unconscionable. What do we do with that set of circumstances?
Well, I do think that the lack of clarity of what the assets were at all lies at appellant's feet, and I feel that the court has made it very clear, the trial court.
But appellant's saying, and again, this formula that the district court relied on to come up with its decision that this was unconscionable is based on valuation of non-marital assets. And appellant saying, well, that valuation should have gone to the arbitrator. The district court shouldn't have been doing that in the first place.
Now we're getting into another section of argument. But so the valuation changed throughout the proceeding, and I understand that the terms of the Antinup say it's at the time of service of the petition, but it is also very common that trial courts consider the gains or losses or changes in assets as a proceeding goes on.
Well, and I agree with you. But here, if the antinuptial is valid,
yes,
then why wouldn't the district court have to apply its provisions and have to award your client more money because in 2019 he had more money?
I'm lost on that piece of it. Award him more money?
Award your client more money.
Yeah.
Because what I'm saying is, if the antinuptial is valid, mm-hmm. and it says your client is at 12% or 14%?
Yes. Off the top of my head, I don't remember which
row.
We'll
call it 14%.
Yes.
And if the antinuptial is valid, she's supposed to get 14% of the difference between the valuation of his non-marital property in 2019 and her non-marital property in 2019. And let's assume the best set of facts for your client. Let's say her non-marital property has no value. He's at $5 million, which is basically what the district court said. If that's valid, that means your client is supposed to get 14% of $5 million under the antinuptial. Isn't that better for your client? As opposed to 14% of his valuation at the time of the dissolution, which the district court put at $1.5 million.
If there's anything that is clear, it's that the trial court had really no idea of what property existed, marital or separate.
That's not entirely true, because the district court made findings, as you said. Time of marriage or time of execution, $7 million. Time of dissolution, initiation, about $5 million. Time
total
of
assets.
Trial, $1.5.
But total assets. I don't think she's attributing any part of that to his net separate. She wasn't able to determine.
No, I think the district court, when talked about the 2019 assets, you know, referenced his business, referenced the sale of this other business.
All of the assets.
Referenced his home, which was deemed to be a non-marital. It wasn't all assets. The district court specifically pointed to assets that were identified as non-marital assets when it came up with that $5 million number or thereabouts, which makes perfect sense because the district court is trying to decide whether or not the antinuptial is valid, and the district court's applying a provision in the antinuptial that says when you're dividing non-marital property, you award a percentage basis of the value of that property. So the district court would only be looking at non-marital property to do that analysis. And once again, what I'm getting at is I have some concerns that no one is reading this antinuptial and actually applying it, including the district court when doing its comparison, because the district court didn't apply it correctly according to its terms for the purpose of determining that the antinuptial was unconscionable.
So, Your Honor, if I can just reference the actual decree, because I do feel the answers to this case are within the decree. Starting on page 32, the court starts to make its findings about property division. It includes a chart at page 33, and while it does reference assets that existed at the time of the antinuptial, it does not denote whether they are marital or non-marital. It just denotes the total of $5,018,467. And then later, on page 37, in finding 141, husband argues property is his non-marital property and he should be awarded it, but the court disagrees. She explains that
but here's
there's
the problem.
No documentation.
I'm trying to stay in the space of is the antinuptial valid or not?
Yes.
The district court concluded it wasn't, in part because if you applied its terms to the conditions as they existed at the time of trial, it would be unconscionable. But If you're applying its terms to reach that determination, you have to apply its terms correctly. And its terms say you use the percentage allocation based on the value of his non-marital assets at the time the dissolution was initiated. And the district court says in its findings that as part of the parties' antenuptial agreement, parties agreed that wife would receive 35% of the marital property. No one's disputing that. And 12% of husband's separate property if they're married for 14 years, which they were. At the time of the antenuptial agreement, husband's net worth was, we'll call it $7.8 million, meaning wife would have expected to receive at least $935,000 and some odd change as part of her share of husband's separate property. The court then went on to say things have changed since 2005. At the time of the initiation of the dissolution proceeding in 2019, and this is finding 95, the parties still had significant assets. $2 million in brokerage accounts, almost $500 in retirement, an additional $2 million in Lazari and Santori, homestead appraised at $1.7 million, and that's husband's homestead according to the terms of the anti-nup, an unknown value for Tiger Oak, which again is a high value. We don't know what it is. But my point is, those are the numbers to which the judge should have applied the 12% allocation. And if you apply the 12% to those numbers, you come up with a much higher number representing the amount your client was entitled to under the antinuptial than you do if you apply the 12% to the value of the assets at the time of the trial, which is then $1.5 million. So my point is, under the terms of the antinuptial, your client was supposed to get 12% of what husband's non-marital assets were worth, less the value of wife's non-marital assets. That's not what the district court did in reaching its conclusion. Do you agree?
I do, and here's why, though, Your Honor, this is so important. Okay. It's because the district court was not able to determine at all what his separate property was because, for example, he had sold the residence he owned at the time of the antinup and they bought a new one. There were 18 years of payments on mortgages. There was so much activity that happened between the antinuptial and enforcement that she was not able to make any. You're assuming that the assets she's listing from his ICMC statement are proven to be a separate or non-marital property, and she's saying, I can't tell that at all. She's viewing all of
Here's
that as marital.
If the antinuptial is valid, she doesn't get to view it all as marital, and that's the point here. That's the first thing we have to decide. And you're making this sort of circular.
It is very circular.
And you can't just say, well, she couldn't tell you if it was non-marital or marital. Well, if the antinuptial is valid, she doesn't have to. It tells you what is marital and what will always remain marital, regardless of any contributions of assets. I mean, it spells everything out. So you don't get to, it was very difficult for her to prove what was marital or non-marital, unless you first establish and work, convinced the district court didn't err, that the antinuptial was invalid.
But there still has to be some proof of what assets exist from the antinuptial. You're assuming that the assets listed in the antinuptial now still exist in their same
form.
Well,
and I'm not assuming, I'm reading what the judge said. They had significant assets. Here's what they were. The
yes.
judge made some findings.
Yes, but she does not differentiate between separate or marital property.
But if we were to be concerned that, okay, look, you, district court, you applied the terms of the antinuptial to reach the conclusion that it was unconscionable. You applied those terms incorrectly. You were supposed to use 2019 as the valuation date and not 2023. Do it over.
Well, she has the absolute right to take into consideration changes in valuation. We do with
Understood.
All assets.
Understood.
So I don't think it's fatal that it's 2023 valuations instead of 2019. I would just point out the one other, in finding that it's valid, appellant has raised the fact that she only analyzed two of the Kinney factors. Well, even in Kremer, they only analyzed two of the Kinney factors
right.
and stopped after analyzing two.
But we have the issue of the facts being very different than Kremer.
And they will be in every case, Your Honor. That's the thing.
And absolutely, but that's why you have to look at every case. But you, yes. You can't say, well, here are two cases with factual circumstances that are distinct as to 90% of the circumstance, but here's one that's the same, therefore I can say this other case governs here.
But then aren't we substituting appellate review of the facts instead of deferring to the trial court's findings of the facts regarding, I mean, it's a factual finding.
Understood, but there's factual findings as in someone testifies to something, someone testifies in another way, and the judge has to resolve that conflicting testimony by determining who's credible. Absolutely defer there. But when a factual finding is based not on that sort of weighing of evidence presented at the trial, but instead on a district court saying, I'm applying this law to reach this result. It's a legal analysis that supports this factual finding, and my concern is with the legal analysis the district court used.
And I'm just thinking of the duress finding, Your Honor, where Ms. Bednar gave a very lengthy description of why she felt under duress, and even though she had representation in the months preceding it, she felt that was duress. The trial court found it was duress, even if it's different than the Kremer situation.
Understood.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have
another question. And I did take up a significant amount of your time.
There's a discrepancy in the numbers for the wife's income, and I was curious if you could address that. There's the child support. The court said it's $2,000 a month, and then employment purposes is $3,200.
Yes, and I believe there's a finding within the decree that says that the distribution portion of income wasn't guaranteed, so they were using the W-2 portion, which was $2,000 a month. The bigger error that appellant raises is that the spousal maintenance amount was not included in her income. And if we read 518A.29, it says spousal maintenance that's received should be included. And we can see throughout the proceeding that he didn't pay. It was being paid from assets. They ran out of the $300,000.
Part of the statute, are you? It doesn't, appellant cites a statute that says when determining a parent's income for purpose of calculating child support, you must include any spousal maintenance previously ordered or ordered in the current proceeding. Is that correct statutory language?
I'll read the statute from the Minnesota Reviser site, 518A.29. Says that, subject to exclusions and deductions, gross income includes any form of periodic payment to an individual, including, then there's a long section, but it says spousal maintenance received.
Okay, could you give me the site again?
Yeah, it's literally the statute, 518A.29.
29, thank you.
And it's subdivision A, and it says spousal maintenance received. And it's really clear throughout this proceeding, I mean, at the time of trial, they had exhausted the fund of $300,000 that her support was being paid from. He had $52,000 in arrears. He was not paying.
Okay, but here's what I want to direct you to. 518A29,
yes.
Subparent A.
Yes.
And that says, subject to the exclusions and deductions in this section, gross income includes any form of periodic payment to an individual, including but not limited to, and one of the things is, spousal maintenance received under a previous order or the current proceeding.
Received. And she wasn't receiving it anymore.
How would, just a sec. Here's my question.
Yes.
How would you receive spousal maintenance ordered in the current proceeding? If the purpose of the current proceeding is to determine whether or not there should be spousal maintenance and what the amount is, doesn't that language suggest clearly that if in the proceeding there has been a determination that spousal maintenance is appropriate, then the amount of that spousal maintenance is included for the income calculation?
And you'll see that in the child support worksheet that the court attaches and relies upon, Mr. Bednar is given a deduction for $8,000 a month
for payment.
I know, but why isn't she given?
Because she wasn't receiving it. It was ordered but not received.
Okay, let's go back to the statutory language.
Yep.
It says spousal maintenance received under a previous order.
Received.
Or the current proceeding.
Right.
Received. So you're reading that to say spousal maintenance received in the current proceeding.
I believe this is a case of exceptional circumstances.
No. Counsel, yeah. would you answer my question?
Yes, that is, okay. That is where my position
comes from,
that she wasn't
logically
getting it.
Does a person receive spousal maintenance as a result of an order in the current proceeding if the order doesn't exist until it's issued at the end of the current proceeding? It, to me, that suggests we're supposed to put the amount that is ordered into the column and calculate it that way.
I think that usually works, Your Honor.
Okay.
But at the bottom of page 32 of the decree in footnote 4, the trial court describes how he has insisted on not paying support. And even after she voluntarily agreed to reduce her support, he basically lied about his income and didn't pay it. So this is a case where this trial judge, who has presided over these parties for 4 years, has seen that this party will not pay. She can order it, and he has the deduction of $8,000 on the child support worksheet, but it's not coming into respondent's account. She's not receiving it. She's not actually getting the money. In most cases, in a case of first determination.
So you're saying in other cases, we would include it because we presume the guy is going to pay.
Yes.
But here he has a history of not paying, so we're going to presume he's not going to pay in setting child support. Another way to do it would be to give him the benefit of the doubt because we now have a dissolution, we now have an order, presume he's going to pay, use it to accurately calculate the child support, which, as you point out, might result in him having to pay more maintenance because everything plays off of everything else. And if he doesn't pay, then she comes back to court in a few months and said he hasn't paid, and we start that whole process.
Except there had been an order for payment in place for years, and he hadn't paid. And at the time of the trial submissions, he was $52,000 behind. And shouldn't he have to come back to court and say, now I am paying, and in fact, now I made up the $52,000? And it goes back to statutory interpretation.
But, you know, here's my concern with the arguments I'm hearing here.
Yes.
We don't like this guy. We don't like what he's been up to. He's been a real treat in this litigation, and I think that's clear. Therefore, we're not going to apply the law.
No,
we would normally give any other guy the $8,000 credit. It would go in mom's column to show she's going to get $8,000. But we're not going to do that for him because he's done all this game playing. I don't know that we can do that.
Except the plain language. The plain language of the statute says for it to be included in her income, she has to have received it, and she's not. And this is a case that's different than the usual ones.
Well, it says the word received comes after the phrase in a previous proceeding, received, or issued in this proceeding. Does the word receive apply to the phrase after the or, which is a disjunctive?
I am going to get the statute right here again.
And it's in paren A.
Spousal maintenance received under a previous order or the current proceeding. So spousal maintenance received.
Okay, I stand corrected.
In the current proceeding. And I do think that
usually. But I don't understand how you receive
it goes
spousal
in your
maintenance in the current proceeding, if you're defining received as paid, because there would be no obligation to pay it until after the proceeding.
Except every case is different, and this went on for 4 years. And at the time of the trial submissions, there was a $52,000 deficit in child support and spousal maintenance. And even before that, the only reason she received any support is there was $300,000 sitting in her lawyer's trust account, and her lawyer was paying her according to the order. And when that ran out, he didn't ask to modify. He didn't do anything. He just simply didn't pay it. And footnote 4, page 32, shows how absolutely intent he is on not paying. He negotiated a lower support package, told her that he was no longer receiving pay as the
Counsel,
CEO.
I'm going to just say he's intent on not paying because he thinks he's got a valid antinuptial, which has not been enforced. I think it's coming back to the antinuptial. But are there any other questions, Respondents' Counsel? All right. Thank you. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to duress, it's a very high standard to meet. We did cite a case, Hill versus Hill, 356 Northwest 2nd, where the parties were married 2 days. Or I'm sorry, the parties signed a prenuptial agreement 2 days before their marriage. It's very similar here, as both parties' attorneys signed with their client's authority the prenuptial agreement 2 days before the marriage. Just as has been done here, the parties could have always continued the wedding if there was truly any type of duress or just chosen not to marry. With regard to arbitration, you know, it seems like there are issues regarding what the value of certain assets are, even more reason why arbitration should have been compelled and arbiter should have made these decisions. So we're not kind of guessing what assets are and what's non-marital and what's marital. At the same time, you know, I think the arbitration clause speaks volumes regarding the valuation date. That's what should have been implied, the 2019 date as far as enforcement. Even if the court would look at a 2023 date, Mr. Bednar, my client, his business was shuttered. He went through a long, lengthy bankruptcy proceeding. He spent almost, as I understand, almost $1 million and attorney's fees related to that proceeding, and he only had about $1.5 million left. When you're analyzing unconscionability, you're looking at the total circumstances, including what's left of the marital estate.
It seems to me this gets worse for your client, that if we use the 2019 valuation date, there's a lot more assets that were available there. So we're looking at $5 million versus $1.5 million.
The court in the decree has provided for a $2.5 million equalizer payment or thereabout. If we used a 2019 date, that 12 or 14% might only be about $900,000. So that would be quite a bit different than what the court has ordered. With regard to 518.29, I believe the position by respondent is illogical. This assumes that maintenance will never be received. I don't think that was the intent of the trial court. This is a clerical error. I've seen other trial courts make this same error. With that, if...
I think Respondents' Counsel was, I think, saying there was an order earlier in these proceedings, and your client never paid, right? And so the receipt of that never came in throughout the years of litigation that this was going on because your client wasn't paying.
And again, I think it's a stretch to misapply the statute in that way. And if that was the court's intent, I would imagine there'd be very detailed factual findings stating they're not going to include income received as a part of spousal maintenance and the child support calculation. But in doing that too, if that was truly the trial court's intent, the trial court would implicitly be acknowledging that the appellant doesn't have the ability to pay $8,000 per month plus in support payments to the respondent.
But what do we do with all the findings of bad faith and defrauding that happened throughout all of these proceedings that says your client has been hiding assets for years and misrepresenting things in bankruptcy court and got fired and replaced as the CEO of a company because of those defrauding? I mean, there's a lot of factual findings in there that we really can't touch on the bad faith stuff.
These issues are best addressed by the prenuptial agreement and specifically the arbitration and the arbiter who would have authority to determine what's marital and what's non-marital.
Well, let's say if we say the antinuptial agreement is valid, the attorney's fees, at least as to conduct-based, would still be valid, wouldn't it?
Under the prenuptial agreement, each party would be responsible for their own fees.
But that's conduct basis separate. That seems different to me because you're saying there's some bad faith here. Your conduct in this litigation caused this to go a lot longer than it should have.
And if there were an award of attorney's fees, it should be relative to the exact conduct that occurred. I mean, the court awarded every single dime, frankly, that the respondent requested for fees, which is over almost $250,000. Here, you know, if there was, and again, as far as bad conduct, if there's a transfer or transfers that the court is unhappy with, I mean, it certainly doesn't cost $250,000 relative to those actions.
Well, it depends on how much your client was hiding assets and defrauding, which again, that gets into these factual findings from the district court.
And again, I think the arbiter would be in the best position to really determine how to divide these assets and debts. I have no more time, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience with our questions and for the briefing. Obviously, you've raised a lot of issues and they're complicated. We will do our best to work through them and certainly have a decision to you within the 90 days required by law.